This is John Wrigglesworth from Sheffield Hallam University. I'm talking today to Blair Matthews from the University of Bristol. I saw Blair give a brilliant presentation at the Glasgow PIM in November 2016. In it, he looked at how research on international student experience often puts students into cultural and national groups, and then goes on to talk about the problems or deficits that those groups have. Blair uses the idea of individual identity and agency to overcome this group deficit approach. And he brings in the work of sociologist Margaret Archer, and particularly her work on reflexivity. And he's able to argue that getting students to reflect on how they engage with the world is a useful way to ease their transition through UK higher education. Hi, Blair.
Hi there.
Could you start by outlining what you see as the problems with the way that intercultural theories talked about international students?
Okay, right. So intercultural theory suffers from conflation in that we use culture to categorize students. So either, you know, Chinese, and usually nationality is a proxy for culture. So Chinese students behave like this, or Saudi students, or sometimes even generically just international students. And the issue with this is this tends to mean that we ascribe causality to these national distinctions where there is none. So we might say, for example, that in general, Chinese students might speak less in class, where it's a generalization. We attribute that to their national culture, individualistic cultures or collectivist cultures or something like that. And Margaret Archer argues that this form of conflation is wrong in that it misidentifies the causal powers of agency, in that people tend to negotiate with the world as an individual with their own identity and agency.
So Margaret Archer has these ideas of culture, structure, and agency.
That's correct. Yeah.
Could you just outline those terms for us?
Okay. So Margaret Archer's is she wants to identify causality. So the idea is that social theory tends not to be able to identify causality in any particularly good way. Her approach is to improve the way that we can identify causality in society. So one way she sees it is that society is stratified into culture, structure, and agency. And each part of the stratification, each level, has its own causal powers. So culture, for example, refers to the values of a society. So, for example, the recent refugee crisis, somebody noticed that it's often a lot of males, who young men, who are coming to Europe. So she argues that in North African culture, for example, young men are expected to provide for the family. So culture has a causal power in that it provides the values. At the structural level, we might have war and poverty are the sort of make life sort of constraining and brutal. And at the agency level, it's what matters to me. So the individual looks at the world, says, I need to earn money for my family. I can't do it here, so I'm going to go abroad. And it's similar in the international student experience. We have these values, cultural values of higher education, and the world's getting richer and better educated. It's a Western form of education that's privileged. We've got, at the structural level, we have agencies, institutions, governments who facilitate the movement of global movement of students. And finally, at the agency level, we have the individual choices of the students. They deliberate reflexively on their own world and decide, oh yeah, I'd like to do this. And that's how they manage their own resources.
So these are all features that focus on a particular individual student then, rather than a group?
You can refer to it collectively as well. So you can have collective agency too. So groups of people might, social network might privilege Western education over a home education, for example. So you'll see social institutions being developed that will facilitate that.
Mm. And that takes us to the idea of reflexivity, doesn't it?
Yes.
And this internal conversation. How does that work?
Okay, so typically in social theory, we tend to remove the individual's thoughts from the explanations. So, for example, if you take a cultural theory, it's the culture that explains behavior. If you look at identity theory, for example, it's psychology, feelings, emotions like culture shock and stuff like that that explains why people become the way they are. So Margaret Archer argues that this is inadequate, and she wants to emphasize the role of thought in creating social structures and creating values and things like that. So reflexivity can be found between the structures and the agency. So we reflect on the world in an interrogative way. So we question the world around us, and that informs our behavior.
So how, when you took all these ideas together, how did you bring them to bear on your research question and the methodology that you used?
Okay, so initially when I started my research, I wanted to explore the social support of international students. So it's quite well established that social support is a strong influence in the success or not of students. There's a lot of research that says that international students in particular lack social support. And when I was building up my research, I noticed that people managed their social resources reflexively, in that they deliberated on who they wanted to talk to, who they wanted to spend time with. We're limited in terms of time and things like that, and the people we can talk to. So it was very agential, shall I say. So people were making active decisions about who they were spending most time with. And from that, I did a mixed methods approach. So I mapped social relations. So I give the students a cohort of about 100 students surveys where they listed their friends at three different points during the year. And at the same time, I interviewed a group of five students who knew each other twice during the year. So I got a longitudinal data set where I could look at how social networks changed over the academic year, and triangulated with interviews where students were talking about their relationships and how they thought about them, how they developed them, what kind of resources they put into them.
So what sort of things did the students say about these matters?
Well, initially I found that right at the beginning, so I gave the first surveys in induction week when few students knew each other. They hadn't started their classes, they didn't know where they were. So the social networks there reflected same culture networks. So initially when they first arrived, they were drawn to the people similar and familiar to them. So it was national culture that sort of predicted the initial networks, not just national culture, but that was the dominant one, gender as well. So you notice there was a gender split and things like that. As the year went on, so in December, at the end of the first term, we did another set of things. And what it showed, there was a significant change in social networks. So rather than nationality being a predictor of friendship or social support, it was discipline. So it was the people they were spending most time with. Some disciplines were mostly from one nationality. So for example, engineering was mostly young Chinese men, 18, 19 year olds. They were all that sort of network sort of stayed with them throughout the year, and it was quite difficult for them to escape it. So even if they wanted friends, English friends or different nationality friends, they were sort of bound into this network that had formed at the beginning. Other disciplines, so for example, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, psychology or something like that, which was much more mixed. It was much less predictable by nationality. So those networks were very mixed. And what you found with those networks was that the dominant behavior of the cultures became less important with time. So their behaviors and values converged over time. So whether they were very different at the beginning, by the end of the course, they were talking about things in the same way. So they had similar values, similar habits. And this indicated a significant shift in the way they individuals engage with the world.
So is that moving from the cultural to the structural level?
Well, they're sort of co-constructive. So the culture, yes, so the cultural values changed during the course. And that was through the structure. So structures were, social networks were constructed, and what they had to do was construct their own values. And those values were often imposed by the institution. So, for example, you had to do your homework, etc., etc. But often those emerged from just the discussions they were having. So the shared experiences they were going through.
And those shared experiences were, what sort of things did they talk about when they were talking about those?
Well, they talked about things, the conflicts that they encountered. So they evaluated their experiences very positively. But of course, some of them are better better adapted or better able to adapt and things like that. So we talked a lot about what did you think about when you encountered a problem? So an argument with a friend or a problem with an assessment or something like that. And what you found is that the data is not really strong enough to make any generalizations, but there were sort of different patterns of behavior emerged from different structural features. So, for example, students who didn't make strong friendships, they tended to engage with the world independently. So those who, in contrast, those who made strong and deep friendships, they tended to engage with the world communicatively. So they, if they come across a problem, they'd go to a friend. Whereas those who had a lack of social resources, they were compelled to engage with the world autonomously. And what I found that was that we use autonomy as a sort of, we trained students to be autonomous, but the structural features that sort of resulted in autonomy were kind of negative. So people who were autonomous were also a little bit unhappy with their experiences. They negatively evaluated the sort of friendships and things like that. But they were highly autonomous in that if you gave them something to do, they'd just go and do it.
Will these understandings play into how we understand autonomy?
Yes. So, for example, at Bristol University, we have tutorials. I think it's quite common for everyone else. But so, what I found is quite useful when you're talking to one of the students to be able to categorize them in some way. So if they seem to be, so Archer sort of distinguishes between different patterns of behavior. She talks about communicative ones who have strong friendships. Autonomous, who lack friendships, and then you've got something called fractured reflexivity, which is where emotion is intensified and effective action is difficult to exercise. We might call that culture shock, but it's commonly characterized as culture shock. So what Archer brings is an explanation of how that emerges, and her explanation.
And that's fractured reflexivity.
Fractured reflexivity. So an example would be a student's given an assessment with a deadline, works all night on the deadline and sleeps and misses the deadline or something like that. It happened to me last week. It was a student. A student missed her presentation because she was working on it all night. So her action was ineffective for what she needed to do. And it was underlined by her anxiety and stress and things like that. So the emotions constrained her agency. Archer brings is that explanation. So we can identify why people might be performing poorly or exercising agency in an ineffective way, which makes it easier for us to identify solutions. So we talk about planning and things like that.
So planning is one of the things. How should the EAP teacher best apply these ideas into the classroom to give the students a better experience?
Well, it's kind of stronger than just the classroom. The structures encompass the whole experience. What my research showed that it wasn't just, I mean, classroom networks were important, but once class finished, that was it. It was students went to their own accommodation or something like that. It's built more into the tutorial system and support systems and things like that. So to be able to give students maximum opportunity to engage with others is something that's sort of come out from this. So students who are maybe feeling a bit fractured or anxious or stressed, they are given the opportunity to come into college on their days off or speak to their tutor at a more flexible time or something like that. We encourage student societies, volunteering in the community. So the idea is that we offer students maximum opportunities to engage with the world. Not all of them will take it, but they generally do.
So that's fascinating research. Have you got plans for a next step in what you're doing?
Well, all my research has identified is a possible link between the way structures have set up and how students engage with the world. It's a small sample, so it's not definitive, but it does feed into future planning. So we have started schemes like having students engage with the local community, for example, voluntary networks. So students, particularly graduate students who come with a strong set of skills already. So they're encouraged to volunteer in shops and Oxfam and Mind and places like that. And those are related to university applications and things like that, so that they are building up a set of habits and skills with that'll benefit them in the future.
There's some fantastic slides from your presentation on the Barleap website, and a great list for further reading. If there are one or two things that people could look at to get them started in looking at Archer's work, what would you recommend?
Yeah, well, Archer's work is quite, well, impenetrable might be the word when you first start in it. She talks to a particular audience. She's talking to other social theorists, and she speaks, you know, it's quite hard. She's not a particularly good presenter. But the two things that I would recommend, there's a blog by one of her ex-PhD students called Mark Carrigan, markcarrigan.net, and he's got a blog where he summarizes the different modes of reflexivity that Archer talks about. Similarly, Graham Scambler, that's scambler.com. He's an emeritus professor at the UCL in health, social science of health, and he also summarizes Archer's work in a good way.
That's fantastic. So Blair Matthews from the University of Bristol, thank you very much.
Thank you.